David Bowie recorded two of my songs, Feel Your Heart with Love Today and Buzz the Fuzz. Did a okay job on Feel Your Heart for a white guy, very stiff, but you don't expect him to be able to sing because he's mostly theatrical and he's British. So what does he know about music, right? He ain't American, and that means he ain't in touch with Mississippi mother. That's David Bowie's story.
And that was Biff Rose, the eccentric songwriter and all-round character, pondering on Bowie's version of his Fill Your Heart, which kicks off side two of Hunky Dory. Well, I might have to disagree with Biff here, but then what do I know? What I do know is that this is a colossal chat, and quite rightly so. Hunky Dory, as so many of us agree, is magnificent. It's the album that I would say really showed for the first time what exceptional talent and originality bubbled in the Bowie bosom. It comes to a crashing climax at the end of side one, with Quicksand, so now we flip our vinyls over to side two, and we're in for another mad wild trip. This time around the borders of America, as Bowie, full to the brim with ideas and inspirations from his first stateside trip in September 71, gives us his first major label cover version, with the aforementioned Fill Your Heart, pays sardonic tribute to Warhol and Dylan, emulates Lou Reed in Queen Bitch, also paving the way for Ziggy Stardust, and then closes out the album with one of his most extraordinary tunes to date, the Bewley Brothers. Now, my guest Nick Pegg always says he doesn't do favourites, but I suspect this might really be his. I think it's definitely mine. It was released in December 71, and in retrospect, I think we can look at this album as being the firework display that heralded Bowie's career in proper. It's packed with sublime songwriting. It's got an esoteric musical palette, for which we must also acknowledge the mercurial talents of band leader and the future Spider from Mars, Mick Ronson, the keyboard virtuoso and yes man, Rick Wakeman, and on production duties, the former Beatles engineer, Ken Scott. So this conversation picks up from our chat from the last edition, we're on to side two, and I begin by asking Nick, to what extent do you think Bowie's first trip to the States in September 1971 shifted his worldview in songwriting? Let's go. During the recording of the track, during 1971, Bowie goes to America.
Yes.
For the first time.
Yeah.
And this is for someone who's gone on record so many times just explaining what a big deal America was to him growing up, and you know, his Soho years with his brother Terry in the 1950s and his love of jazz and R&B. To go to America just blew his mind in every sense.
Yeah.
Is it simplistic to say he went to America, came back as Ziggy Stardust, and then recorded Song for Bob Dylan, Andy Warhol, Queen Bitch?
I think it might be a little bit pat, but no, there's no question about it. You're absolutely right. Of course, these songs came out of that. I mean, don't forget, he'd already, you know, he'd been a fan of the Velvet Underground since his early manager, Kenneth Pitt, came back with an acetate of that first Velvet's album. Before it had even been released, Bowie had recorded a cover version of it, you know, with his band. Bowie didn't release his version, but so he'd been a Lou Reed fan for goodness knows how long. And of course, he'd known about Andy Warhol and whatever. So these weren't kind of new things to him. But the difference was he'd actually been there. He'd actually gone to America. And but of course, he had already recorded the song Andy Warhol before he met Warhol. So it's not as if... You know,
it wasn't like he went over there, met all these people,
and then came home and wrote songs about them. No, not exactly. No.
Okay. But certainly, it was a big, big, big.
Oh, it was huge, huge, absolutely.
And I feel you feel this in the, because we're at a point now where we, in the old days, we'd have flipped the vinyl over, and we start with, now it's Biff Rose.
That's right.
Is the writer, and is he? He's American.
He's an American singer-songwriter. Very much. He's very hippie. He's very sort of flower power. Released an album in 1968 called The Thorn in Mrs. Rose's Side, presumably referring to himself, you know, as the side of it. I recommend, and you know, anyone who's into Bowie and into Hunky Dory, it really is worth a listen. It's a very kooky album. It is, it clearly meant a very great deal to Bowie. He was very impressed by it. This guy, he's almost, I mean, Bowie described him as a flower power Randy Newman, which is a great, that is bang on, because that's exactly what you're hearing on this. He's a very eccentric songwriter. There's some very crazy stuff on there. There's another song called Buzz the Fuzz, which Bowie also covered at the time. He didn't record a sort of big studio version, but he used to do it live. That's about a policeman in the land of the free and the home of the hip, I think it is. But it's a kind of jokey song about a girl called Alice D.
Right.
LSD, get it?
Oh.
And it's got a line, it goes, love is so inspirational when you... No, sorry, life is inspirational when you fall in love with eyes dilational or something like that. These are the kind of lyrics.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds great.
It's definitely checking out some more Biff Rose.
And there are, I mean, seriously though, that album is fascinating to go and listen to just for the little bits and little echoes that you suddenly realise, oh, Bowie really loved this album, didn't he? There's another song on it. I'm digressing madly here. There's another song on it that's called What's Gnawing at Me, in which Biff Rose goes on a little walk downtown feeling very self-absorbed. And of course, those who know the David Bowie song Conversation piece, it has the line to find out what's gnawing at me. You know, so these are just little echoes of things, you know. There's another song on it called The Man, which Bowie had clearly must have had in mind when he recorded his famous demo Shadow Man, which many, many years later he brought to fruition in the Toy Sessions, and that's one of his great sort of under-the-radar songs, isn't it? Shadow Man was one of the most... But if you go and listen to that Biff Rose song, The Man, Bowie clearly... I'm not... You know, he didn't nick it, but there are bits and bobs in that song that are...
It was
are
clearly present in his mind.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So anyway, getting back to this actual song, Fill Your Heart, this one, it was co-written by Biff Rose and Paul Williams, who's one of those songwriters it's one of those careers that you just go, wow, look at that career. He's an actor and a songwriter. He wrote the songs for Bugsy Malone. He wrote the songs for that marvellous, crazy glam rock thing, The Phantom of the Paradise, have you ever seen it? In which he also appears. He appeared much more recently. He's in the film Baby Driver. He has one scene and gets horribly shot. Oh, spoilers, sorry. He's also one of the apes in one of the Planet of the Apes films. So hooray, if you're out there, Paul Williams, I love you. So he co-wrote Fill Your Heart, a song that obviously Bowie loved, and again is, in this version, hugely distinguished by a really... virtuosity of Rick Wakeman's piano playing on it is one of the great moments on Hunky Dory. I think it's this wonderful sort of helter skeltering, you know, it's like
a tack piano or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got that old honky tonk style going all the way through. And yes, you're right, those wonderful little fills and runs at the end.
Yes, yes.
And again, it's like we were talking earlier about the light and dark. It's a very happy.
It is, and I think this is crucial because it's like this, as you said, this opens the second side, and I don't think we should ever underestimate the care that Bowie put into the, you know, the programming, the order of the tracks on his album. So we've just heard Quicksand. Don't believe in yourself. Don't deceive. You know, I'm sinking in the quicksand of my thought. And then you turn it over and you get forget your mind and you'll be free. It's like the opposite. It's like don't sink in the quicksand of your. Yeah. Come on, here's the, you know, and that is, you know, it's someone else's song, but it fits so beautifully into the album's scheme of things and into Bowie's scheme of things. And this became one of his trademarks after this, over the years. He would often do a cover version on an album that seems to fit so well into the album's scheme of things that it just, you know, it was meant to be. Just another little side issue, by the way, also recorded during the Hunky Dory sessions was a song that was held over for the next album, It Ain't Easy, another cover version by Ron Davies, which of course ends up on Ziggy Stardust.
Yeah.
And to a lot of people, it's a mystery why he included that song and missed off some of the others. I think it's great. I love it. I think it fits beautifully. But again...
It is a bit of a... Just to briefly digress to but it is a... bit of a strange. I mean, I can say it's not my favourite song on the album. It Ain't Easy. Why do you think he chose that song in particular?
That's a very interesting question. It Ain't Easy, of course, is quite a devotional song. Again, you know, God is quite heavily involved in it, and that's an interesting aspect of, you know,
it's a struggle of faith.
It is, and Ziggy Stardust, even more so than Hunky Dory, is an album that's full of priests and churches references to, well, faith, you know. There's quite a lot of that in Hunky Dory. There's a cathedral floor coming up at the end of the at the end of the album. So that's very interesting. Interesting choice of song. Yeah. It's not all about religion, of course, but it does, you know, it has something with the help of the good Lord, we can all pull on through and so on.
So that was the cover which ended up on Ziggy. And of course, Fill Your Heart was the first cover that Bowie released.
It's the first time that he'd included one of somebody else's songs on one of his albums.
Which, like you said just now, went on to become a bit of a hallmark.
I mean, there's a cover on... It's not every single album, but it does become a bit of a Bowie motif. I mean, he didn't do it on the Berlin albums as well. He didn't do it on Low and Heroes. We might you know, quibble about Red Money on Lodger, which is a sort of remake of a Iggy Pop song, but he co-wrote that song anyway. So, but then by the time he gets to Scary Monsters, yes, he's doing it again. There's Kingdom Come on there.
And then from there on, pretty consistently again.
Until you get towards the end. His last two albums don't have any, you know, The Next Day and Black Star Earthling, are all his own work. Yeah, Earthling is all his own work, as is Outside, of course. The cover versions wouldn't really have worked in that scheme of things, would it? But anyway, so it's not all of them, but it is here we are back nearly all of them.
What would go on to be a very intriguing canon of cover versions, you know, like a really sort of, you would always get a bit curious why he chose this song and what, because they were very rarely just like a big obvious hit.
He wasn't someone who was going to
Neil Young or Tom Verlaine Television and so on. Pretty obscure stuff.
Jonathan Richman, cover of Pablo Picasso.
He kind of sets the bar here with Biff Rose.
Reflecting
what, you know, I think he's always was always famous for was his love of what we now call outsider artists. So of course the legendary Stardust Cowboy, Biff Rose, and then maybe something like Syd Barrett, you know, people hovering around just on the perimeter of fame. And like you said earlier, you know, he's always attracted to these eccentric, strange characters. But really now I do want to find out more about Biff Rose, because he sounds quite
an interesting character.
Well, cat.
It's you know, it won't be everyone's cup of tea. You know, Bowie was a big fan of stuff that was really out there, and this and the Biff Rose album is out there. It's not it's quite it's almost punky in its in places in its production. You know, it's very sort of spit and sawdust. You know, but that's part of its charm and part of its style. And there's sort of performance poetry on it as well.
Moving on, we have now a bit of sort of like a New York trilogy.
Yes, that's right.
One of the gods in Bowie universe, I think, at that time, Andy Warhol. In actually not interesting points in his career. I think he was shot in 1968, and a lot of things changed for Warhol after his shooting. He moved up a few strata in society. He started trying to ditch the sort of the seedy, seamy, you know, Lower East Side Manhattan scene of the 1960s.
And he became slightly more of a member of the set instead. Right.
That's kind of the direction he was moving out when these two met in 1971. I mean, I think the same year Warhol had a big retrospective at the Tate in Sweden as well. He was certainly moving in a sort of very, very rarefied circles. When Bowie met him, Bowie, I think there was an interview I remember hearing where Bowie was laughing after saying, well, it was actually the best possible encounter I could have had with Andy. He didn't say anything.
Yes.
That's what you want.
He had absolutely nothing to say. Yeah.
I didn't meet him until, I guess, the early, late 60s, early 70s. I can't remember the year. I found him in it was an incongruous kind of situation. The guy was in the factory place, and it was a hive of activity. Everybody was doing something, talking up this, talking up that. And the guy was just sort of very quiet, sort of like a lethal kind of Svengali figure over this whole thing. Everything happened without his seeming to be taking any part in it. He was an extraordinary hypnotic kind of guy. He was very, very funny, very witty man, but it took a long time before you got him talking. I wrote the Hunky Dory song before I met him, and then I played it to him at the factory, and he said, oh yeah, that's great, and that was his critique of the song. I don't know if he ever liked it or not.
Clearly, it's a tongue-in-cheek song. There's no question about that. You think about Paint and you think about Glue. What a jolly boring thing! That's another very British.
Very jolly boring
thing to do. But it is definitely admiring, I think. And after all, you know, Andy Warhol, Silver Screen, Can't Tell Them Apart at All. That's such a Bowie. Mm-hmm. You know, that's such a insight into Bowie's own process, isn't it? Yeah. You know, he was, I think what fascinated him about Warhol, one of the things that fascinated him about Warhol was this, you know, the blankness, which of course is part of Warhol's famous fascination, is the, you know, why does someone want to paint a Campbell's soup can? Why does someone want to do these screen prints of Marilyn Monroe and put them in a block? It's not just the works of art themselves, it's what's behind them. Yeah. And Bowie himself was, you know, particularly at this time, was really into the idea of, say, I'm a blank canvas, project onto me what you will, there's nothing behind, honestly, look, turn me around and there's nothing there. And of course he was playing with us, that's completely untrue, of course there's not nothing there, you only have to listen to the songs on Hunky Dory to know that.
But he was always in love with this idea. I mean, look at this big love of Isherwood. With his I am a camera, I'm seeing all this, one day it'll have to be developed and fixed. But Isherwood's very self-conscious blankness in that sense, just, I'm recording, I'm a documentarian, made a colossal impact on Bowie as well, didn't it?
Yes, so definitely.
That's interesting with Warhol, Isherwood, you know, this kind of fascination coming through with this blank screen.
That's right. Imagery. And, you know, as we said earlier, this is all part of the film, part of, you know, the album's preoccupation with cinema as well, you know, hooked to the silver screen. This comes up again and again. Maybe we should mention the cover of the album, which is like a sort of hand-tinted lobby card of Lauren Bacall from back in the day, isn't it?
You know, theatrically sweeping back there.
That's right. He's sort of doing this sort of Greta Garbo thing, isn't he? And you know, quite deliberately, it's a black and white photo that was then hand-tinted into colour to give it that sort of strange, retro, very glamorous sort of Hollywood-y, cinema-y.
Very grainy indeed.
And I think that's part of the whole sort of cinematic silver screen fantasy world that this album sort of hovers in and among and above. And
it makes it very explicit. I mean, on the back, it's produced by Ken Scott, in brackets, with help from the
Assisted by the actor. Yep, exactly.
There you go.
Yeah.
Casting himself as the actor.
As the actor. And of course, let's add, in two songs on the album, and again, let's marvel at the sort of structure and balance and unity. In the first song and the last song on the album, they both contain, not only do they both contain the word faker, but they're specifically about other people perceiving Bowie as a faker. You know, how the others must see the faker. And then in the Bewley Brothers at the end, you thought we were fakers. Again, these are just little echoes that are put there for us to sort of play with, for us to sort of dangle and think about, you know. But the idea that he might be concerned that people think he's a faker, but he's saying it before we do, you know. He's
kind of preempting that particular thing, which he knows will come, and of course will be coming in future years as well,
you know,
as the masks slip and shift.
Absolutely.
Do you think in this song he's accusing Warhol of being a faker?
No, I really don't, actually. I don't think he's accusing him of anything. I think he's observing him.
But
I don't think he's calling him a faker. I think he's admiring Warhol's audacity and his humour, and to a certain extent his sort of cheek. Many years after Warhol's death, Bowie sort of took their relationship to the next level massively by playing Warhol in Julian Schnabel's film, his rather wonderful and underrated film, Basquiat. Yeah, and there's no two ways about it. Bowie's performance in that as Warhol is partly the way it's written, it's partly the role of the character, but it is a comic performance, and it's a really, really funny comic performance as well. But nonetheless, you are terribly sad when Warhol dies, when it gets to the, you know, when Basquiat hears the news that Warhol has died, it's devastating in that film. But Bowie's performance is that's a scream, you know, and it really is. Bowie's only Warhol is a scream.
The amount of loose ends that we can tie silver screen, Bowie on the silver screen, and then ending up on the silver
and
screen.
And in Basquiat, he's actually wearing one of Warhol's real wigs. Yeah. I mean, that's quite remarkable, isn't it? It's kind of, I don't think it's, you know, sinister or anything, but it is quite sort of, ooh, wow.
It's Bowie amazing. Doing his method acting.
Yeah.
I mean, I've often wanted to have a Warhol wig myself. I don't really know if that would suit me, but...
I'll let you know. Send me the photos and I'll let you know.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to send you the photo of me dressed up as Bowie at one point. I went to a Bowie party a few years ago in Berlin, and anyway, this is a conversation for later. We come on now to another icon. We come on now to another figure. We come on now to another colossus, titan of American contemporary culture in the early 1970s.
Yeah.
Who was also perhaps past his first flush of influence, maybe, or fame, whatever, and kind of maybe had lost his way, certainly if you were part of the far left counterculture movement, which acclaimed Dylan as their own in the 60s. And this is a rather finger wagging song.
Well, it is. Now, this is, I think, far more so than Andy Warhol, which I've never really seen Andy Warhol as a snide song or anything like that. Yes, it's a bit of fun, but I think it's admiring. Song for Bob Dylan is full of admiration for Dylan, but at the same time, it is actually a bit of a riposte to Dylan's, it is finger wagging, as you say. I mean, it's very interesting, this idea that, you know, Dylan was so important to so many people, including Bowie, but so many other people. Of course, we know about the famous sort of Judas moment and all of those sort of things, that people felt so let down by him because he'd started doing different stuff, which is really interesting. And Bowie wasn't the first person to do a song like this, you know. Country Joe McDonald, who Bowie had actually shared the bill with at the Roundhouse with Hype a year or two before, In 1970, Country Joe and the Fish released a song called Hey Bobby, which was another one of a similar sort of plea to, it was kind of, you know, these songs are both sort of addressed to Bob Dylan saying, you know, come back and do what you used to do. We need you. We're missing you. And there was a thing called the Dylan Liberation Front, wasn't there?
That
was
kind Leverman.
Of, yeah, which was around about the same
lunatic.
Time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've heard any of those. Years ago, a friend gave me a cassette of the conversations between Dylan and this guy.
You're right.
And this guy was, he called himself a garbologist. Right. And he was rooting, Dylan had, in what he then said was one of the stupidest moves in my life, was that he'd moved his family back to Manhattan from Woodstock. And around 1970, I think. Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, his thing was that I never wanted this mantle of, you know, spokesman for a generation. I never wanted to be the prophet. I never wanted any of this. And he was after the motorcycle crash, which, you know, sort of has assumed legendary proportions
now.
Yes. Escaped up to Woodstock, did music from the big, did basement tapes and so on. But I'm, in listening to Song for Bob Dylan, yes, it does echo the Country Joe song, and it does have that give us, you know, it's putting a lot of, you know, a lot of dreams and hopes onto this
give
man
back
who blatantly doesn't want to play the game anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting. It's also, you know, Bowie himself, a few years later when he was, you know, giving some fairly spicy interviews anyway, around about the station to station time, this song was brought up. And Bowie said something about, you know, this was partly Bowie kind of staking out his claim on Dylan's territory. You know, I think he said,
move over and let grow.
But in a very 1976 Thin White Duke sort of way, I think the way he phrased it was, he said, I sensed that there was a leadership void. I think is what he said. I thought, oh, crikey. You know,
God knows what he was talking about at that point in his career.
No, exactly. I mean, he was just trotting out all sorts of remarkable pronouncements at that point, wasn't he? But I think another interesting and important thing to realise about Song for Bob Dylan, and all of these songs, Andy Warhol, Queen Bitch, is not, they're not just, you know, they don't exist in a little bubble exclusive to the rest of Hunky Dory. They actually work very well as part of the whole Hunky Dory album. Right through Hunky Dory, there are children and mamas and papas and brothers and sisters and things like that. You know, obviously the Bewley brothers, whatever. And in Song for Bob Dylan, you know, the sort of crucial plea is give us back our family, isn't it? Like, you know, so this
is like our unity.
Our unity gives back our family. Yeah, and that's an interesting sort of little tug back to you know, it brings it into the world of the album, and also of course this theme which I was talking earlier on about the sort of the creative process and the well of inspiration and everything, because the chorus, one assumes, is about Pallas Athena, who sprang from the brow of Zeus. Here she comes. Mm-hmm. Here she comes again, the same old painted lady from the brow of the superbrain. That's it. And this is, you know, we're talking about a creative muse here. You know,
has referenced Pallas Athena. Indeed,
he did. He did a song called Pallas Athena many years later, a sort of club rave number. So, you know, this is, once again, as in Quicksand, as in Changes, he's singing about the creative process, you know, what it's like. He's not just singing about Bob Dylan, he's actually singing about what it's like to be David Bowie as well, I think, you know.
I see.
It's also got a lovely Mick Ronson guitar line in it, and another lovely piano play out from Rick Wakeman as well.
These two, Ronson and Wakeman, are really, really just knocking them out of the park. Tunes. They've clearly found a groove there in the pocket.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, but something else I wanted to talk about this track is that he's clearly taking the piss out of Dylan. You know, with
yes.
Now, listen, now hear this.
Oh, he's doing. Woman, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wrote a song for you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like you'd have those old folk ballads, like, you know, like Dylan himself. You know, Song for Woody Guthrie and Song.
Yeah.
Song for.
Well, of course, it's clearly referencing that, isn't
exactly,
it? Yes. Yeah.
It's really taking. It's parodying that whole form that, you know, is the song is calling for him to return to.
Yes, that's right. Yes, and the fact that he does the voice. Well, of course, Bowie was, and we've talked about this before, Bowie was a fantastic mimic. He you know, and he could do all sorts of wonderful impressions of people, and he doesn't just. When the moment is right, he'll trot them out. And he's not, he could have done a far more cartoon Dylan voice if he'd wanted to on this
subtle,
track.
Isn't
you know,
it?
Yeah, it's subtle, but there is. Yeah, he's just, he, as you say, he just puts in that sort of that Dylan thing. That sounded more like Marlon Brando. I mean, Brian Eno tells a wonderful story that, you know, several years later when they were working on Low, Bowie recorded a vocal of always crashing in the same car, impersonating Dylan so well that he actually convinced Brian Eno that it was that Dylan had been into the studio and done a vocal for it, and he played it to him. And Brian Eno,
I'm just trying to imagine that in my mind right now.
Yeah.
Every chance.
Yeah. And actually, if you hear that song, you think, oh, yeah, no, it could be a sort of Dylan type of a song, couldn't it? Yeah, yeah. But yeah, Brian Eno said it was great. Bob Dylan had never sounded better. He said it was wonderful. So, yes, I don't know if that version still hangs around in the vault somewhere, but wouldn't that be something?
Is there anything that you know of on record about Dylan's response to that song? Did he ever respond? Did he ever have a...
Do you know? I don't know. I don't know if someone must have asked him about it at some point, mustn't they?
Such a... Yeah, so there's an interesting. I remember reading somewhere about this where he was, by his own admission, fairly lost at this point. You know, he was trying to find his own way. Mm. I think in the song "Watching the River Flow," which from around this time, the first line is, "You know, what's the matter with me?"
Yeah.
But he was out somewhere in the countryside, and when "Heart of Gold" was a huge hit.
Yeah.
And he said the song was driving him crazy because he thought that's what everyone wants me to do. You know.
Right. Yes. Like yes.
You know, so that he said, I thought it was myself. He said, my father called me up and said, I can hear you on the radio again. And he's like, no, it's not me. But Dylan himself was in a very strange place at that point. So, yeah, I thought there might have been some sort of...
Interesting, yes. There must have been. Someone must have. Well, of course, Mick Ronson went on to play with Dylan on the Rolling Thunder review, which was a big thing, you know. And Ronson, you know, worked with Dylan for some good time on that, you know. They must have talked about it, mustn't they? Yeah, I don't know. That's fascinating, isn't it?
What does David mean with this? I don't know. But that I quite like these two. I'm sorry to use this word again. These two icons.
you're allowed to say icons. You're allowed to say icons.
I like the fact that they're, you know, he's you know, America is now big and Technicolor and open and Hollywood. Yes. All these themes that we've been talking about, from The Sleeve, The Actor. You know, it is this very British take on America, and after a song for Bob Dylan comes one of the most American sounding songs of the album, which is this super fuzzy, scuzzy 1, 2, 3, 4
and straight in with that turbocharged guitar.
Exactly. That fuzzed over riff comes in, it's just, wow, it takes off.
Yeah.
And this, of course, is the precursor to a lot of the Ziggy feel.
That's right.
But where did this come from?
Well, of course, the number one influence on Queen Bitch is, of course, Lou Reed and, you know, the Velvet Underground. And Bowie was a huge admirer and became, you know, of course, a collaborator and a friend of Lou Reed. Then they had a slightly rocky relationship over the years, but they by the time of Bowie's 50th birthday concert, they were the best of friends. They both lived in New York, and they did Queen Bitch together at Bowie's 50th birthday. How marvelous.
It's lovely, that.
It's very interesting, actually.
King of New York.
Yeah, he says, and you can see how delighted he is that Lou's on stage. You can see how delighted Lou is as well, actually. Yeah. He cracks into a great big smile when they start Queen Bitch.
King of New York himself, Mr. Lou Reed.
Also very interesting that entire 50th birthday concert, the only time that Bowie asked one of his guest singers, of whom there were several, to do one of their own songs, is they do Dirty Boulevard together from Lou Reed's New York album, which is a great song. And, you know, that's Bowie stepping back from the limelight and saying, here you go, Lou, do one of yours. Yeah. You know, he had a huge, huge respect for him. So getting back to the very beginning of all that, Queen Bitch. Again, like we've been saying about so much of this album, yes, he's channeling this ultra hip street New York, I'm going to say it now, icon to him that Lou Reed was, but it's a very British song. It's still, it's filtered through, it's written by an Englishman who has, you know, so that gives it part of its fascinating lyrical energy, you know?
Do you mean just the sheer pleasure he's taking in the language of the lyrics?
Yeah, I think it's partly the distance between, you know, he's kind of trying to... You know, it's not that it's inauthentic, but it is very much an Englishman trying to sound like a New Yorker in a skyscraper watching the cruisers below, and it's all. But you see, it's full of it's got that sort of very English sort of Polari type of feel to it hasn't it? Yeah, you know, which is something that Americans don't quite do. And Lindsay Kemp, I think, rears his head in this song. You know, Bowie's famous mime and dance teacher from a few years earlier, who was still, you know, hanging around with, and of course came and did some work on the Ziggy period with him as well, and on some of his shows. Satin and tat was one of Lindsay Kemp's favourite little phrases, apparently, really? To describe his sort of mixture of theatricality sort of seedy glamour. You know, he said, oh, we'll just, you know, pop some satin and tat on it and it'll all be fine. You know, this was one of his sort of phrases. So when Bowie sings She's So Swishy in her satin and tat, that's a little bit of Lindsay Kemp just popping its way into the song. And in her frock coat and bippity-boppity hat... I mean, what a line. This is a song that succeeds in making the phrase bippity-boppity hat sound rather cool.
I wasn't aware of the phrase bippity-boppity hat before that.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think it may be the first known usage. Yeah. I think it could be the coinage. Well, I don't know. Coinage, is it?
It's a very, very onomatopoeic word, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know exactly what a bippity-boppity hat looks like because she's wearing it with her satin and the tat.
Yeah.
But again, he goes into these wonderful little lyrical swirls in the middle and then it just goes back to this like angry buzzsaw guitar.
Yeah,
doing this Eddie Cochran style riff over and over again, which of course we would see coming on with "Hang On to Yourself."
Yes, exactly.
Ziggy, Gene.
This is an interesting thing. I mean, in one of our previous chats in this podcast, I forget which one it was now, but I think it was when we were talking about "Never Let Me Down." I mentioned that you can always, you know, any given David Bowie album is like a sort of bridge between the previous one and the next one. By the same token, pretty much every Bowie album has one track on it that is very much, you know, the shape of things to come. This is the tryout for what's happening next, you know, or the one that you know, by the time he got to the next album, Bowie was thinking, right, that's the template. And clearly, Queen Bitch, it doesn't stick out like a sore thumb, but it is very much, okay, that's your proto Ziggy, that's what's coming next, you know.
Did you record that when he came back from America, or was that recorded before
he went to America? Well, he went to America twice. He went to America at the very beginning of 71, but at which point he was still promoting the Man Who Sold the World.
That was quite an underwhelming tour. That was when he was with, I think, Ron Oberman.
Yes, that's right. And he couldn't actually do gigs because he didn't have a work permit.
His parents' house or something. It was all very low key.
Yeah, absolutely. He went to some parties, networked a bit, and you know, strummed his guitar at a couple of private do's. But then he went back again.
It was that second trip
later. Later in the year. The second trip was the time that he met Warhol. Yeah, but by that time, most of Hunky Dory had already been written and indeed recorded.
So I don't know if it's in your splendid book that I had read that he came back from America and so energized and motivated was he that he quickly cut Queen Bitch and it was like a very late inclusion in the album. I mean,
it is a late one. Yeah, absolutely.
And like you said, sticks out like a sore thumb. You know, because it has a completely different feel. It has a different, and it has that very forward-looking atmosphere to it. Okay, this is what's going to come now.
Yeah,
right? You know, sorry, Rick. You know,
It's
like dun, 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 dun. That's what you need. Yeah. Just that killer riff.
Yes, absolutely. Rick Wakeman is nowhere to be heard on that song. Yeah, exactly. And he's not on every track on it, of course. There are other. You know, Andy Warhol doesn't have the piano on it, and so you know he's not all over the album, Rick Wakeman. But
I love the BBC version where you can just hear him mutter louder.
Yes.
And, you know, when they're just starting off and up on the seventh one, watching the cruise below, louder.
Yeah.
And you just hear some BBC engineer go, shoved up a little bit. And that's also very, very prophetic as well. Come on, louder.
Yeah, yeah. To be played at maximum volume.
To be played at maximum volume. Well, before we get to maximum volume, we end this album with an absolutely extraordinary track, The Bewley Brothers. I mean, just... It goes backwards a little bit because there's some of the themes which could be said to be dealing with mental instability and illness in the form of his brother Terry. That even like the squeaky, scary little voices, which we first met in The Man Who Sold the World.
That's right. In All the Mad Men, they're sort of
exactly. Yeah, again, it's a song of nighttime and of shadows and of, you know, scary, creepy, shadowy thoughts. And then there's a sort of encounter in the middle, like a very homoerotic encounter in the middle. I was stone and he was wax, so he could scream and still relax. I mean, it doesn't take much imagination to figure out what's going on. So all these themes are all wrapped up again in this wonderfully rich, dense, dark, pretty scary song.
It's terrifying.
You don't want to be left alone at night listening to those little goblins at the end.
Just come away.
Just come away.
It's... You know, I said earlier on that I don't do favourites, but if I did, then Hunky Dory might be it. I also don't have a favourite David Bowie song, but if I did...
well, you've said this three times now.
The Bewley Brothers is hard to beat.
I don't have a favourite, but if I did...
No, I'm playing with you, I'm toying with you. No, the Bewley Brothers is, to my mind, one of David Bowie's masterpieces. It's in his... you know, top 10 songs or whatever. I don't know, let's not make a list, but it's as as great a piece of work as any that he that he produced. I think it's quite extraordinary, and apparently it came to him very quickly. Unlike Changes and Oh You Pretty Things and Life on Mars, and you know, these were songs that were demoed and worked on and honed and written. The Bewley Brothers was written very, very rapidly. You know, one day he just I think he said afterwards he might possibly have smoked something, and out came
the lyrics. You hear at the beginning the creak of a stool, the deep inhale.
Yeah, and which I'm sure is a deliberate, you know, let's put that in, absolutely. And he initially went into the studio one evening just with Ken Scott, the producer of this album. It's someone else we haven't mentioned, actually. Poor Ken, let's mention him. He'd engineered the Space Oddity album and, you know, the previous albums, but with Tony Visconti no longer on the scene, David Bowie offered Ken Scott his very first producer's gig, which was Hunky Dory.
Of course, he was working with the Beatles throughout the 1960s.
Yeah, he'd worked with the Beatles. He was a very experienced engineer. But yeah, this was the first time he got a producer's credit. And so, yeah, Bewley Brothers, by Bowie's account, began, you know, entirely. It was just Bowie and Ken Scott in the studio. Of course, you know, some of the other musicians came in. There's that wonderful steel pedal guitar, which is Ronson. It's an extraordinary song because, it tumbled out of him very rapidly. It is one of the most, even for Bowie, one of the most allusive, all that we've been talking about interpretation of lyrics. You know, this is a song that really can mean whatever you want it to mean, and that's part of the point. You know, that's part of the absolute point of this song. So yes, we can see there is a gay subtext that can be winkled out very easily from the song, but then look at it from another angle, and maybe that's some kind of... maybe that's just a red herring. Maybe that's not what the song's about really at all. But of course, David Bowie's songs aren't about...
In trying to approach this song, you do land on certain elements, just kind of like cling on to these...
That's right. Like grasping at smoke, isn't it?
It's grasping at smoke. To record a song of such density, of such philosophical and spiritual inquiry into such poetic lines and such vivid... imagery, I think it's just...
Flashing teeth of brass. Yeah. I mean, you're the crust of the sun. You know, these are extraordinary lines. Yeah, and they, as I say, it's not unlike Life on Mars or Quicksand. It's a kind of sense of collage about it, that the images come hard one upon another, and they each one on its own is, you know, something mysterious, but put them all together, and it's like a great big forest full of mystery, which you just... have to wander through and you know, find your own way, and I love that about the song. And it then acquired a sort of mythical status, because, you know, you and I are far from alone in it being one of our favourite Bowie songs. It was always a great fan favourite, but Bowie didn't perform it live for years and years and years and years and years. Not until 2002, in fact, when he performed it. First time he did it was at a BBC live session for BBC Radio. And then after that, he did it at a few concerts, but only a very few. He in fact did 5 performances ever of the Bewley Brothers. I was lucky enough to see one of them at Hammersmith in 2002.
I read something about this. Maybe you tweeted about this recently or something.
It was.
I mean, I think I would have cheerfully given a limb to be there. I mean, like, to see this song in particular, a song which... Again, it's very hard to talk lucidly about some of these songs just because you can't convey how much they mean to you and what you get from them. I think doing this podcast series is an attempt to try and maybe get there a little bit. But a song like this can just enchant and kind of bewitch you.
Almost. Yes.
And this is certainly a very witchy song.
Oh, yeah. There's something, it's almost like a spell, isn't it?
It's a spell.
Bowie did occasionally talk about it, but he... always managed not to nail it to the wall like a butterfly and explain anything, you know, because that would have just ruined everything. And he knew that. But there's a wonderful quote that he said about it. He said, there are layers of ghosts within it. Now, there's a good line, isn't it? Oh, thanks, David. That explains everything. Yeah. Isn't that wonderful? Layers of ghosts. It did clearly mean a lot to him. And yes, of course, there's a resonance about his own half-brother who, as we know, you know, suffered from major mental health problems. And Bowie was very fond of him and you know, grew up sort of with that as part of his, you know, teenage years and his, you know, his youth at this time, you know. And there are other songs, All the Mad Men and Width of a Circle and songs like that, which you know, approach this from various angles. So there's that, I don't want to call it a universal song because that just sounds so glib, doesn't it? But it is a song that can be read and understood in, well, an infinite number of ways, really. You know, we've all got our own version of the Bewley Brothers in our heads, and they're all the correct version. Whatever it is, whatever it means to you, that's great. Well, you know.
And I think that, in conclusion, is the motif of this album, pretty much.
Yeah.
Is that there is so much information here, yet the power of interpretation and the way that we look at these and the very deep personal relationships that a lot of Bowie fans have with this particular album,
yes,
I think are precipitated by this, by the depth of illusion, but by its accessibility.
That's right. It's an extraordinary achievement, an extraordinary sort of sleight of hand almost. Yeah. That yes, it is a bottomlessly profound album, but it's also just, it's almost easy listening, you know, it's great. It's just so, it's a wonderful thing to just put on. Yeah.
As a reasonably accomplished pianist, his compositions here are mind-blowing. I saw on 5 Years Wakeman demonstrating,
talking about the chord sequences,
in Life on Mars.
Yep,
it keeps going in an unexpected direction.
Yeah.
And it tracks the lyric.
Yes.
In many cases, the music tracks the lyric perfectly, or it provides an excellent running commentary, you know, like a little emphasis sometimes,
yes,
or like a little ironic wink or something. Yeah. It's very expressive.
Yes, yeah. It really is. And Bowie knows exactly how to. It's an extraordinary gift, because and it does partly come from, I mean, I've said this before, I think it does partly come from the fact that he had little or no formal training as a musician, which was very liberating. He didn't know what the rules were, so he went ahead and broke them. And that's what made, that's one of the ways in which he was a genius, you know, because this was an extraordinary talent. And so Bowie wrote chord sequences like no other songwriter did, you know, because he was just going, he said he once, I think it was on Parkinson, he talked about hearing Oh for the Wings of a Dove from Mendelssohn's Hear My Prayer, you know, right, which is one of those, those sort of choir boy treble pieces that used to get played on the radio a lot. He remembered his mother singing along to it every Sunday or whatever it was, you know. And that is, if you listen to it, a piece of music which, in Bowie's words, the notes went the wrong way. You know, it goes, oh, for the wings of a dove. And it's really odd. And yet it's still beautifully melodic. Yeah. And if that's what was in his, you know, burrowing its way into his childhood brain, that's how you end up with
definitely
these extraordinary...
And not having the orthodox training that I assume Wakeman had.
Or Mick Ronson. Either of them. Yeah, then, absolutely. Then,
The upside of not having that training would be this very, like, you know, again, the Beatles, or, you know, these native talents where it just came out.
Yes.
I think absolutely Hunky Dory is an album that stands slightly apart in the canon. It crystallizes so much. There's so much in it. What can I say?
Yeah.
But you've said it excellently for me.
We maybe have scratched a couple of surfaces.
We maybe have scratched the surface of a few surfaces.
As
ever, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on board.
It's been an absolute pleasure scratching away with you, Arsene, as well. No, it's wonderful to talk. As I said, you could do a whole series about Hunky Dory. But anyway, there's a starter. I mean,
fantastic.
Just some of the reasons why it's a classic, I guess.
Hey, please come away. Hey, just for the day. Hey, please come away. Please come away. Just for the day. Please come away. Please come away. Please come away.